Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
If you're just joining us, I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller this morning, and this is NPR News. Now let's turn to the topic for the rest of the hour. Is socialism making a comeback, and what does that even mean? Socialism has never been popular in America. The German socialist Werner Sombart in 1906 wrote a famous book, Why Is There No Socialism in the United States? At times in our history, advocating for the S word could be branded as naive at best and un-American at worst. Yet recent surveys routinely report that millennials seem willing to embrace the socialist label. The focus on young people and the direction of their political beliefs picked up with a surprise primary win by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is the 28-year-old Democratic socialist who won her primary in New York in an upset over a 10-turn incumbent. To make sense of the trend, I'm joined by Kathy Cohn, chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, but she joins us from Martha's Vineyard. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of younger people looking favorably on socialism? What does socialism mean to you? Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828, and online it's talk@nprnews.org. So, Kathy, we have these surveys. They show younger generation having a favorable view of socialism. Well, let's just step back for a moment. How is socialism defined in these surveys?
Well, I mean, the thing about public opinion surveys is generally you don't define the term. So part of kind of the pushback that we see from those who would oppose what looked like a trend of favorable intentions or affections towards socialism, part of the pushback is to say that young people don't even know what they're saying that they have favorable feelings towards, right? That they don't have a clear sense of what socialism is, both as an economic system or as a political system. And really what you're seeing in these surveys, some would argue, is that people are just frustrated with what they understand capitalism.
Right. So and so, again, these surveys also don't define what is meant by capitalism.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, part of the reason I think I'm on here is that we have a survey. It's called the Gen Forward Survey, the Survey of Millennials. And in our survey, we also found that young people, and we oversample young people of color, so African-American, Latinx, and Asian-American millennials, were more favorable in certain ways towards socialism than they were towards capitalism. And this, of course, has started kind of a wildfire, we might say, around what does it mean for the future of politics that young people, and in particular millennials, who are now, you know, bigger than baby boomers in terms of a generation, that they seem to be more favorable towards socialism.
Yeah. So are you surprised by these results? Are these results confirming what you were picking up in previous surveys?
Yeah, I mean, we're actually not surprised by the results. And I always remind people, this is a generation, right, that grew up with the kind of changing and restructuring of the economy. If they didn't experience, for example, deindustrialization directly, they saw their parents, many of them, lose their jobs or, you know, lose the idea of a kind of safe living wage income. They've grown up with neoliberalism. They've grown up with globalization. They are experiencing the after effects of the Great Recession, right? This is a generation that has to deal with college debt. So for them, in many ways, kind of the kind of capitalist framework is a framework that hasn't really produced the trajectory of mobility that often comes with talking about capitalism. And let me just add, especially for young people of color, who suffer from double the unemployment of young whites.
Right. Yeah.
Capitalism per se has not been a winning strategy for themselves or their community. So we're not surprised by the findings.
So part of it is, for example, an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal editorial page I read a while back, and person was extremely upset about young people not knowing their history, and they were talking about East Germany under the Stasi and Romania. And I'm reading this and I'm going, no, actually what they're thinking about is Denmark, Sweden, Germany, Switzerland, that have universal health care and universal retirement, and wondering why can't we do that?
That's exactly right. I mean, these are not young people who grew up with the Cold War, right? So their reference for socialism is something very different. They think of socialism as almost something that their grandfathers, someone like Bernie Sanders, might ascribe to. So they are wondering, why am I saddled with all of this college debt when other countries, in fact, provide free public education and free college education? They're thinking about kind of Medicare for all, and they're seeing their grandparents have better health care than they do. And so for them, it's not just that the economic system is failing. It's also that the political system is failing, right? They see incredible polarization between the parties, an inability to kind of get anything done. They then have great alienation. And in fact, in our surveys, we find that large majorities of young people, independent of race and ethnicity, want a third party because, in fact, they believe that the Republicans nor the Democrats are really functioning as they should. So I think both in terms of their economic situation and how they look at the political system, they think, why not socialism? And not Cold War socialism, but something we might even call soft socialism of a Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right? That's what
right.
they're
referencing. Okay. So I want to go to the phones, and we have Justin. And Justin, you're calling from Duluth?
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. So what is your observation or question?
Yeah, well, your guest sort of summed it up for me is that, I'm not really a young person, but I'm still in the workforce. And you look at, like she pointed out, people who are receiving the private health insurance you receive through employer, it seems to get more and more expensive out of pocket every year. And you look at, our grandparents, they have Social Security. And,
right.
And then.
Hello?
Just a Scandinavian country. Oh, maybe you lost me.
No, you're back. You're back.
Okay. Yeah, if you ever travel to the Scandinavian countries and you see the high quality of living there and the lack of poverty, socialism looks pretty good and it looks efficient. And this healthcare is really inefficient in our country right now. It's so expensive. And sure, it's great, but it's everything's so expensive. And so I think that capitalism doesn't always, and of course, we have a lot of socialism in our economy. I mean, we have social insurance with Social Security and Medicare and the old traditional employer-provided pension plan was pretty socialist itself, guaranteed retirement. So, and that's not around anymore for a lot of people. And I think they wonder there's got to be something better out there. Anyway, that's my thought.
All right. Well, thank you for your thought. I want to just go right to Anne from St. Paul because I think she sort of has a parallel observation. Anne?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, Justin stated my thoughts. We live in a society already where we have a combination of capitalism and socialism. You take socialism out of it and, we'll have no libraries, no paved roads, and crumbling infrastructure. It's important that that socialism exists. And I am a firm believer in a strong safety net. And I think that we need to start emphasizing that a little more. We don't need so many B-1 bombers. I would like to see, cutbacks on the military and, God help you if you should raise that, because people just...
So what do you mean by the safety net? What is it that you mean by the safety net?
I think that people should, get some help with school costs. I think that, people are I think there should be... Well, I don't know. I think that people should be taken care of. We shouldn't have any homeless people. All of that should be taken care of. Everybody's basic needs should be addressed.
Okay.
We should be able to find the money in our economy to take care of that. I'm a big, strong believer in that. You take care of the people, and then everything else take care of itself. of themselves.
All right. So, well, thank you. So, Kathy, what are your reactions to these? Were sort of parallel observations that were being made by Justin and Anne?
Yeah, I mean, I think those observations are exactly what we're finding in our survey data. So, for example, we ask a question about, you know, do you believe it's more important to have a kind of free market approach, or that we need a kind of strong government rather than a free market approach to address the kind of complex economic issues? And again, overwhelmingly, young people or millennials say that you need a strong government rather than just a free market approach to address these issues. And like your, you know, the folks who called in, I think young people have grown up with an understanding of the reach of the government in their lives, right? That the government provides us with roads. It should fund our public schools. It should provide levels of health care and access to health care. And, of course, for young people of color, they see the police in their neighborhood pretty routinely, often in a negative light. So it's not like they believe that there isn't a strong state already. So I think for them, it's kind of how do we maximize the presence of the state to produce a kind of level of, if not equality, at least kind of basic living conditions for people that allow people the true mobility that we talk about in this type of American dream. So I don't think young people find this inconsistent at all.
So as part of this, the words that we use for framing, there's an old-fashioned term. It's kind of fallen out of favor, but it used to be called the common good. And the importance of the common good and the civil society, the civic society, and a framework of risk sharing, that's what Social Security, for example, it's a risk sharing mechanism. It's insurance. So these terms, capitalism and socialism, are incredibly loaded. People bring very different things. But if you change the language and you start talking about the common good, some intellectuals will reject the notion of a common good, but many people understand intuitively what you're talking about.
I think that's absolutely right. And you can imagine in the pushback to this kind of move towards socialism that there will be some who will understand that you could reframe capitalism. You could say, in fact, that we can have a market economy, but a market economy that is not just about kind of providing for the 1%, but also provides for the mobility and the uplift of the poor, right? That we can have a moral capitalism. I'm not saying this is true, but I'm saying you could frame it in a way that allows us to think about how do you use markets to enhance the kind of condition of those who are marginalized and oppressed. But right now, that is not what young people are hearing. And instead, what they're hearing is that, in fact, I can be a democratic socialist. I can, you know, support the idea that you still have choice and you still have the ability to kind of make wages. But we can also provide for the people who right now are kind of marginalized and on the outskirts. And I think for millennials, that type of kind of economic inequality is unacceptable, and they're looking for something better.
So let's go to Audra. I hope I pronounced your name right. Audra, you're from Moorhead, right?
Yes, yeah.
Sure. What's your question?
So, it's a point that actually the conversation has naturally migrated to, which is I myself am actually a millennial. And I think it's really important and a big part of the conversation that often gets really glazed over, but was going there right at the tail end, which is that a lot of the millennial generation is so passionate about these more socialism type thoughts and approaches to things, but we're very passionate around a democratic socialism. We want that freedom of choice, and we want that ability to be involved. Many of us are very proud to be in a country where we have that freedom of choice, but we see such massive disparities, especially amongst different minority groups, that it just feels wrong. We were raised to care about one another and think about one another, and that's not being represented in now the world that we're forced to sort of be adults and live in. And it's a great disconnect from what we've sort of been raised and taught most of our lives.
So this is really thinking, to your mind, this is about thinking about what are the practical public policies that would lead to a more inclusive society. I mean, that's what that's what that term socialism means to you.
Yes, taking care and being more responsible and making sure that we truly are creating a place that we say the United States is, which is a place where people can come and they can advance and they can move forward. And we can say that, but that's not the actual society and country that we're living in and creating right now.
Well, thank you. And Kathy, I want to take off of what she was saying. There's this sort of undertone with socialism that the individual's not responsible. You've offloaded a bunch of stuff. And yet what I'm hearing from her, but also from other people, is this notion, no, this is a mutual responsibility. Again, it's back to that notion of let's be more of a society and less atomistic individuals.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's the kind of collective nature of socialism, right? It is the idea that I can be responsible not only for myself, but for my neighbor, for my community, and that I have to have a kind of active role in all of those decisions. And I also think, you know, for young people, again, for millennials, what they are especially attracted to is not just the socialism, but the democratic socialism, right? The idea, in fact, that I can participate in this process of making things better for not only, again, myself, but kind of the country at large. And I think towards your point about policies, these are policies that they recognize and that they support, whether it's Medicare for all or a single-payer system, like free public college education, some form of guaranteed work and housing. You know, I think for most millennials, these things seem morally right and correct, not necessarily kind of socialist policies. And I think many of us who kind of do this for a living then combine those together and say, look, you know, look, millennials are favorable towards socialism when they're really favorable towards a more kind of equitable society, less economic inequality, and the provision of a kind of broader safety net that we lost during neoliberalism for the people who, in fact, need more support, at least to begin the journey towards greater social mobility.
And just quickly, by neoliberalism, you mean?
Well, by neoliberalism, I mean a kind of policy that was put in place or, you know, thinking around the economics and the political that reduced the safety net, reduced kind of welfare, reduced health care, and allow for the deregulation of corporations so that they can increase their profits in a way that kind of took the balance away from thinking about the provision of what we call a safety net for those individuals who might need more support.
So let's go to Jane in St. Paul. Jane?
Good morning.
Morning.
I find this sort of conflation of or the confusion between an emotional response to the economics to just have a massive gulf in between them. Capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty. Everyone has heard this than any other economic system.
Right.
Most of the immigrants to this country, or many of them from Latin America, are fleeing countries that have a largely socialist style of government. They're fleeing it for opportunity in this country. And then the third thing is, number one, millennials are only seem to be focusing, and I have some myself, only focusing on what would be given free to them, like free college, less debt, better health care. No one is focusing on the cost. And there was just a study released that Medicare for All, which is one of Bernie Sanders' favorite things, would cost $32 trillion over 10 years, and you could double all corporate and individual taxes and not be able to pay for that. We do have an expensive medical system in this country for lots of reasons. We're all demanding CT scans and MRIs. I mean, it's easier to pay for medicine when we're not all demanding the highest and fanciest and shiniest technology for every single ailment that we have. But what they don't realize is that in a place like Denmark, number one, everyone pays a flat tax of 8% on their income, which we do not do in this country. If you're below the poverty level, you're not paying that 8%. There's a VAT tax on every purchase that you make of 25%. And in this country, you have to reach almost like a $400,000 threshold to be in the highest tax bracket. But in places like Denmark, you reach the highest tax bracket, which is about 60% at $54,000. So if you're a middle income or upper income professional making more than $50,000, you're paying almost 60% of your wages. So basically, you're giving your paycheck to the government, and then they decide how to give it back to you in the form of free college or extended parental leave or retirement or whatever.
Yeah. So I'm really glad that you raised this because this gets at the core of the issue, because at the same time, you have universal health care, you have universal retirement, and you're spending less money on, if you look at Denmark, you're spending less money on health insurance and health care. But the other thing is that you have very high labor force participation rates in these countries and low unemployment rates. So, Kathy, I think Anne has done is gotten to the core, an important core of the debate here in the U.S.
Well, I think that is the core of the debate, right, is how do you pay for these these policies, right? First of all, we can say that there's a question about the pricing of these policies. I think she said it would be $42 billion or trillion over 10 years. Some people say it would be $20 trillion over 10
right.
years.
And that's a really important fight. That's important to sort that out. Exactly.
That's right. So part of it is it's hard to know exactly how much it would cost. Now, I will say in our survey, we do a thing called a survey experiment, an embedded experiment, and we ask about different policies. Should, for example, the government provide support to workers who have lost their jobs because of automation? And so we ask that question. And then we ask a second question to a second group of people, which is, even if it means raising taxes. And what is surprising to us is that when we add the, even if it means raising your taxes, people are still supportive of the idea of this kind of broader safety net.
Now, so you're asking about raising their individual taxes, not raising taxes on somebody else, which is actually not a always fun.
Yeah, that's right. Raise the taxes on the rich. But I think what's important here is that we're having a dialogue about this, and the compromise will get to the middle part, right? Which is, you know, how much do we raise taxes? What do we cover? What is part of the safety net? But I think for millennials, again, and we keep going back to young adults, to have the conversation is not off-putting. I think for a different generation, often boomers, who've grown up kind of thinking about the Soviet Union or other socialist countries. We often throw out Venezuela and Cuba, who kind of grew up with a kind of Cold War narrative, even thinking about the kind of framework of socialism, this idea that, in fact, we're going to pay all of our money to the government and then they tell us what we get. I think it's not the same discussion for millennials. They are like, okay, what? Think about a shared economy. They're used to a shared economy. What happens if we give more taxes to the government, but we also have a role in deciding how the government disseminates that money? And I think that's what's new at this moment. They just have a very different approach to how they're willing to even think about and discuss not only the kind of framework of socialism, but the specific policies that would be included in an expanded safety net.
So I want to go to John. And John, you're in Rochester, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
And your comment?
Well, you know, I all this talk about the millennial generation, that's great. I mean, they're seeing the world as they see it. It's not our perspective. But, you know, there are folks like me who were raised under grandpa's knee learning about voting for Gene Debs. I mean, there's nothing here that Paul Wellstone wasn't saying before he passed. I mean, these are ideas that have been there forever. I mean, as an earlier caller called and said, you know, the capital system does this and that, but here's the other thing on that. If you don't pay enough taxes or if you don't have a good health benefit, you're playing the negative lottery. You're going to get a $100,000 medical bill you don't know how to pay. Do you want to do it that way? Or do you want to make sure everybody's got coverage? I mean,
So let me ask you, John. I mean, you know, one way of stepping back and looking at this is that this is really what we're discussing has been labeled as socialism, and it has an attractive term, and we do radio shows then about it because using the term socialism. But if you look at it, it is a standard liberal progressive agenda that has gotten a larger voice because of these surveys that have shown that millennials are wrestling with this. Is that sort of how you look at it?
Yes. I mean, the ideas have always been there, but, you know, people have shied away from the term because, well, you know, that doesn't sell well. And, you know, certainly if in a world full of capitalist marketing, obviously they're not going to sell socialism as a concept. It's anathema to their actual premise. So the ideas have been there. So here they are with a term on it, how people pick up the term and run with it, like it or not. I mean,
you're okay with that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, let's go to Benjamin. And Benjamin is in Moose Lake. Benjamin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And?
I want to kind of voice my opinion with some of the other conservative callers, just so we don't get too much of
absolutely
an echo chamber here.
Yeah.
But, no, like I said, I'm conservative, almost somewhat libertarian in some of my ideas, even though I do acknowledge the need for federal involvement in our lives.
Right.
But, I'm a college student in my 20s, working full-time so that I can pay my way through college so that I can contribute to society and not be a burden on others. But I kind of see that both socialism and capitalism are looked down upon for very similar reasons. Capitalism has this bad taste that it leaves in people's mouths because we think of, corporate heads or even wealthy people in the country are selfish, and they're competing in an almost primal way to have more goods and resources than other people. And so society sees that, and they think capitalism is selfish and self-serving. At the same time, conservatives look at socialism, and they'll see the potential for selfish people to freeload on the system and to, not do their fair share because other people are working hard. And I've certainly seen that. I've had coworkers complain about not having enough food stamp money to buy milk, at the same time bragging about their $2,000 home theater system.
So, right, but most people on food stamps, that's not their problem. I mean, food stamps, that people are using food stamps most of the time to feed their families.
Yeah, I acknowledge that, but when people have these basic needs met, there's a potential, the government's going to meet my basic needs, so I don't have to contribute any of my income to that. I will put all my income towards fund money.
Yeah, so another one of these issues that I find fascinating. And thank you very much for bringing this perspective in. I'll just very briefly tell a story. There was, after Hurricane Katrina, the group of people who were moved from New Orleans to, I believe it was either Houston or Dallas, and they were just given debit cards rather than sort of saying you can only spend your money on this, only spend your money on that. Just here's a debit card. Do what you need to do. And most people, as I know, 94%, 96% of the people spend it on their families, to feed their kids, get them milk. But there was a couple of people spent it on alcohol, cigarettes, strip clubs. Tiny minority. But that's what people focused on. That tiny minority, not the 96% that did the right thing.
Right.
It's part of this political discourse. As we're talking about what is going on, the socialism, capitalism, this is a big part of how do we bridge that divide?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I want to just go back and say, part of the work of politicians for selling a policy or an approach to the economy is to justify it. So if we even go back to neoliberalism, and I'm sorry to use the term again.
you're a professor. You have to use these terms.
I could get to use it yet. Well, we saw greater deregulation under Reagan in particular, privatization. One of the things that had to accompany that is to explain to people who are working every day and paying their taxes why we were going to reduce the safety net. And part of that was kind of saying that there were these people who were exploiting the government on your taxes. We saw the trope of the welfare queen develop and be implemented. And so there is an ongoing narrative and suspicion that people who receive some state support are somehow kind of misusing that state support. And the other part is we never kind of really articulate all the state support that lots of us get, whether it's, again, the roads we drive on, the public schools we send our kids to, the kind of public libraries that we visit, right? All of that is about the state participating and supporting what we do. So I think it becomes hard for people sometimes to move away from that kind of discourse and framework that is being produced both by politicians but also the media that suggests to people, look, don't contribute to a system and don't give your money because there are those individuals out there who are just using, who are waiting to kind of exploit the extra money they receive from the government. And, of course, we know that what people receive
is so little, and it often doesn't fully meet their needs. So, you know, that's part of my concern about how we think about this. But what's interesting, again, and I'll be quick, about millennials is their insistence on kind of pushing back against that narrative to say, wait a minute, we live in a country where there's great wealth. How are there people who are homeless? How are there people who can't go to college, even though they have the ability, because they just can't pay for tuition? How is it that there are people who can't feed their children? How is it that we have kind of such high levels of poverty, in particular in communities of color? And I think for increasing numbers of millennials, in particular, I want to make the claim, millennials of color, right?
Right.
African-American, Latinx, and Asian-American millennials who are saying, this is unacceptable. We have to be open to thinking about policies and systems that do this better. And I think that's what we're seeing in this discussion of socialism.
Right. And it's important that, you know, those are the critical questions. Now, people can come up with very different answers about
Absolutely.
How you deal with it, but those are the right questions to be asking. And so, well, let's go to Bill. And Bill is in Plymouth. Bill?
Yeah, hi. Say, I am not a millennial. I'm a mid-50s guy, owns a small business, under 20 employees. Traditionally been a moderate, voted for Hillary because I think in the last election she was the most moderate or perhaps even conservative choice available. Since that election, I find myself being pushed towards the left, towards the Democratic Socialist, which, you know, I didn't even think twice about Bernie, but now I wish I would have voted for him because increasingly over the last 20 years, wealth is getting concentrated at the top, the poor are getting poorer, the rich are getting richer, and the current situation is that's going to accelerate. And I just don't think it's sustainable. And so I think often the best ideas in society do come at critical times from the youth, and I think the millennials probably have it right this time.
Okay, well, thank you. So let's let Nat go to Jamar in Moorhead. Jamar?
My name is Jamal.
Jamal, I'm sorry. My apologies.
That's quite all right. So thank you for having me on. You've had a lot of conservative voices on, but I think you ought to have an actual socialist on. And for people who think that capitalism is a solution, all they need to do is look at their government. You look at net neutrality. You look at financial regulation. You see how that has been weakened over time. That's capitalism working to subvert your government.
So what does socialism mean to you then?
Companies. Well, I'm going to finish here. And,
okay, because we have to keep it. We have to keep it very short.
I'm going to answer your question in doing so. Corporations taking over your government means your government is responsive to your corporations and not to the people. Socialism is a government for the people. It's a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. So, yes. So Kathy, one of the things that, I mean, you can have a democratic socialism, Sweden, but he has brought out this point about we have these two callers. They both have brought increasing inequality. And mm-hmm. one of the things that you do see with increasing inequality is greater power over the past 20, 30 years in our society sort of flowing to the large companies.
Yes. Well, I think if one of the things we did in the survey, again, in the Gen 4 survey, is we asked about kind of trust and favorable feelings towards things from labor unions to corporations and really other than the Congress. Corporations fared pretty poorly, right?
Really?
For young people and for, because I think, again, this is a generation who's grown up thinking about corporations and corporate greed at the same time that they've tried to kind of, recover from a recession where, in fact, we saw corporations, in particular in the housing market, making a profit off of people's failure. So, I think they have negative views towards corporations. Actually, they have relatively positive views towards unions because, in fact, they see them as collectively representing workers. So in many ways, again, it's not surprising that they're saying – and I would go back to one more thing. You know, we often talk about the Occupy movement, and we say, what happened with the Occupy movement? If nothing else, it provided a frame for people to understand economic inequality, right? The 1% and the 99%. And I think people feel the idea that there's greater concentration of corporations and greater concentration in wealth in the 1%. And they're wondering how the 99% course, not really 99%, will respond. And one of the responses is to say maybe we need to rethink the way in which we structure the government and to some degree the economy so that it has greater equity and it's more of a shared economy where we can provide for more people.
So in the 20 seconds left to us, my sense is our politics is being reinvigorated.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.